And joining us today on Perspectives is James Bradley, New York Times bestselling award author. And James Bradley is the author of previous books, Flags of Our Fathers, Flyboys, The Imperial Cruise, and the recent book, The China Mirage, The Hidden History of American Disaster in Asia. James, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Louis.
Now, I know that people who know you, who've read about you, probably not personal friends, but people who know you and have read your work, they're quite aware that you are a very good historian, very good writer when it comes to history, and you've written several books that feature some prominent people. And the first one, I would say, is your dad in Flags of Our Fathers. You want to share that with us?
Well, my dad was one of the guys who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. So if you look at that famous photo of the flag raising on Mount Suribachi, Iwo Jima, 1945, that's the most reproduced photo in history. It's the world's tallest bronze monument in Arlington. We've had it all embedded in our minds like a computer chip by the educational system. It's in every American history book. A friend of mine was studying to be an American citizen. And in the American Citizen Handbook, you have to know about the flag-raising picture on Iwo Jima, I learned. And my father is in the middle of that photo, but growing up with him, he would never talk about it. It was only after he died that I was able to find the story of the six boys who raised the flag on Iwo Jima.
James, that is interesting, the fact that, you know, your father, for whatever reason, did not want to talk about it. Perhaps, you know, he didn't want to brag, didn't want to show off, or perhaps he had some, I'm sure, painful memories of, you know, friends he lost. But how did you come about finding out about this? Were you going through his things after he passed?
After he died, my brother Mark found in a closet three old cardboard boxes. And my father, without my mother's knowledge, had been just tossing Iwo Jima things in there, like letters from every president, from Franklin Roosevelt to Ronald Reagan, just, you know, incredible things. Walter Cronkite said, "I'll do an interview with you. You will put it in the safe. We won't air it till after you die, any condition." And my father would just say no. I found a letter from John Wayne asking for my dad's autograph. So we came upon this stuff, and then my dad wrote a letter from Mount Suribachi 2 days after they raised the flag, and he said the flag raising was the happiest moment of his life. And he never talked about it to his wife of 47 years or his eight children. And I thought, I wonder what happened there. You know, you can't call your dad's friends when your dad's alive, but after my dad died, I just called up the guys who served with him on Iwo Jima and said, you know, what did you guys do there? And I found out they were engaged in the most bemedaled moment in American history. We've stamped out more medals for these guys' bravery on Iwo Jima than we did any other event since George Washington.
Now, one of the things that has come out about that picture, for some people, they may not know also that one of those people involved in the battle there was Captain Kangaroo. Is that true?
No, that's that Captain Kangaroo Lee Marvin email that goes around.
It's a myth?
Yeah, that's a myth. Lee Marvin won the Navy Cross on Saipan, or I think it's the Bronze Star. So there's some truth there, but that those facts about Iwo Jima are not true.
And the story about the picture, some people, for whatever reason, they want to debunk history or not make it as it's supposed to be, saying that it was posed. And they did take another picture, but that was because it needed to be in color, correct? But the one that the photographer took was as it was happening.
Yeah, it's the BBC, NBC, New York Times, almost every large responsible media organization has documented that flag-raising photo I'm talking about was not posed. But the myth lives on. And I wrote a chapter called Myths that shows how that myth began. There was a misunderstanding, and that myth lives on. Maybe 60% of Americans believe that Martians landed in their backyards. Many of them believe that the flag raising was posed, but it wasn't.
We are visiting with James Bradley, New York Times bestselling author of books, Flags of Our Fathers. The China Mirage is the latest book that is coming out, The Hidden History of American Disaster in Asia. Now, this book itself, James, I think a lot of people will be surprised when they read and hear about this history. The first one that comes to mind was the fact that both President Roosevelts were highly respected. They were, you know, one in a time of battle and the other for everything he did as far as workers, unions, everything. They were both heroes. But they may be surprised to find out that President Roosevelt Franklin never worked a day in his life. As far as for money,
But I mean, when you say they're heroes, they're my heroes too. They both did fantastic things. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, you know, won World War II, and my dad survived it. You know, I have a lot of admiration for both presidents, but so I don't know how my book would take away from.
Oh, nothing at all. No,
either presidency. And Roosevelt didn't work. But he worked hard. He was in public service. I mean, the presidency probably killed him. He died at 62.
One of the things, I guess, perhaps I didn't phrase it correctly, is the fact that the money that, just like, you know, the Kennedy family got money from allegedly bootlegging liquor, stuff like that, and that Franklin's grandpa was involved in trade in China.
Yes, the Franklin Delano Roosevelt's fortune didn't come down the Roosevelt line. It came from his mother, Sarah Delano Roosevelt. And Grandpa Warren Delano was the American opium king of China. That opium was the number one commodity trade of the 20th century. It was a huge and profitable business. And some few East Coast families in between Boston and New York sailed out to Canton and made fortunes. Yale University is built on land donated by opium barons. The Columbia University's library, the Low Library, that's dedicated to a guy who was selling opium out in China with Warren Delano. Princeton's first benefactor, John Kerry Forbes, Secretary of State. John Kerry, the Forbes in the middle name, great-grandpa was an opium dealer.
When you talk about Mr. Delano being the opium king, would it be fair to compare him to some of the cartel kings that we have now?
Yeah, it was an illegal business. The Chinese tried to stomp it out, and drug running is very profitable. If you come to New York City and you go to Chinatown, you'll see there's only two statues that the Chinese Americans have erected. One is to Confucius, the other is to Commissioner Lin. Who's Commissioner Lin? He's the Chinese official that asked Warren Delano to stop selling opium in China.
Now, as you mentioned, Mirage, a lot of people know, you know, when they, especially living out here in the desert, they'll say, well, a mirage is something that appears to be there, but is not really what we think it should be. And a lot of people have an image, and it comes across this way in your book, that there was an old China and a new China, and Americans were being sold the new China. Would you mind explaining that?
Well, just like right now, I think the basic comprehension of China is that China's doing something wrong. It has these commie leaders keeping the people down, and there's a wish for democracy, and maybe the lid will pop and these commies will go away, but somehow that old China has to go away. That China that we don't like is going to go away. And then a China that's more reasonable, more westernized, more Americanized, hopefully, pray to God, Christianized, is going to arise. So the idea that China is going to change, you can just see it in how we look at China in terms of the media, and our government outreach. We're still waiting. But this has caused this misunderstanding of China and not looking at China realistically. We have a very narrow bridge across the Pacific. China is 1.4 billion people, one quarter of humanity. And as my book shows, the New York, Washington power brokers, who I call the wise men, have not understood China, and that has resulted in 200,000 American combat deaths that were preventable. And if you look at what's happening right now, we have similar lack of understanding. There's no one at the top level of the Obama administration that has a feel for China in terms of language or any sort of, you know, bridgeable trade, having spent time in China. Secretary of State Kerry went to China, and he spent 24 hours there. That's one-fourth of humanity. He's going to spend weeks and weeks and weeks in in Paris. He knows his favorite restaurants there, speaks French. Geneva, he can use his French. Negotiating in the Middle East, where we're putting our national fortune, that's where we're spending our time. One-fourth of humanity is making the future, and we're not in touch with it.
Now, what about the relationship that President Nixon had with Mao and also Henry Kissinger?
That, you know, I'm of that age when, boom, you know, cover of Time magazine, Nixon and Kissinger are geniuses. They are reaching out to Mao. As you see in my book, in 1944 and 1945, Mao spent hours and hours and hours asking the State Department, I'd like to reach out to you. I've never been on an airplane, but I'll fly to Washington. I'll meet with FDR. Mao reached out to Truman in 1950. He sent an emissary to JFK's State Department in 1961. The State Department gave Mao's emissary in 1961 10 minutes. If we had given him an hour, maybe there wouldn't have been a Vietnam War. So Nixon and Kissinger, Mao was reaching out since 1944. It just took us a whole generation of hating China, of not having relations with China, for someone to shake hands. And since then, Orville Schell, the head of the Asia Society, just wrote online that he went down to Washington and talked to top power brokers, and he says the relationship is, he's never seen it as bad since Nixon and Kissinger went to China.
We're visiting with James Bradley. James is the New York Times bestselling author. The recent novel is The China Mirage, and we're talking about the hidden history of American disaster in Asia. You just mentioned President Nixon and the relationship that he did have when he went over there and visited, and of course the media, as you mentioned, made a real big deal of it, but a few people know, as you just pointed out, that Mao had been reaching out to our government since before World War II, and what was the reason that our presidents, Theodore and Franklin, kind of put that aside?
This China mirage, the idea that China is going to change. When Mao is trying to reach out, explaining to the United States that he, rather than Chiang Kai-shek, who we supported, is going to be the next emperor. And Mao said, I'd love to, you know, work with Wall Street and Washington. This is back in 1944 or 45. And he said, don't keep supporting Chiang Kai-shek. He's going to lose the Civil War. But America supported Chiang Kai-shek. Millions of Chinese died. And Mao arose, and he wasn't the new China we wanted. He wasn't that Christianized, Americanized China. So we broke off relations. I mean, Louis, I have to make this point for your listeners. Imagine you take one-fourth of humanity, and the U.S. State Department position was this. Hey, don't look to Asia. No. Those aren't the real Chinese. Not those Chinese ruled out of Beijing. The real Chinese are on this island of Taiwan, this rock out in the middle of the Pacific. That's officially China. That was the United States position for 30 years. It's ridiculous.
So when they talked about this is the real China, were they, as you said, a mirage, but perhaps fantasy, that these are the Chinese that we want? They're going to be Americanized, they're going to be Christianized, and it's going to be like a Chinatown in America.
Yeah, Chiang Kai-shek was Christian, and as you see from the book, had a real China lobby pipeline influencing American opinion, and Congress supported this fantasy. I mean, our policy in Asia has been warped by the China mirage. McCarthyism is rooted in the China mirage. When Joe McCarthy from Wisconsin, I'm from Wisconsin, when Joe first stood up and waved that sheaf of papers in 1950 and said, I have the names of 223 communists in the State Department, well, in the speech, he only named one communist by name, and that was John Service, a foreign officer in the State Department. John Service was born in China, spoke four Chinese dialects, and he was the guy that knew Mao Zedong the best. Senator Joe McCarthy had to get any contact with Mao cut off first. Everyone in the State Department who dealt with Mao or Zhou Enlai were fired. We had no one in the U.S. State Department in the 1950s who spoke Chinese. So I didn't write the book to help the Chinese. I'm not begging, you know, us to help those poor Chinese in China, Louis, but I'm trying to get us to stop shooting ourselves in the feet. 200,000 Americans have died because we're looking at a China mirage rather than China reality.
So, James, from the research you've done and the history that you've showed us and we read about, what about the future? Because when we look at the future, America seems to be kind of fallen behind, and China and Russia are up at front where we used to be.
Well, you know, Russia's economy is smaller than Belgium's. There's a scare machine that we're supposed to worry about Russia, but, I mean, not Belgium, Holland. The Dutch economy is bigger than Russia. Russia's just pumping out some gas and oil and a few things. How many Russian things that made in Russia do you or your listeners have in your home? You drive in a Russian car or components in your stereo from Russia? No. You know, it's the tiny, tiny. It's China that's one-fourth of humanity. It's China that is going to blaze the future. Now, again, this is not a bold prediction, because if you look at my book, you'll see that China, for the last 5,000 years, for most of those years, they were the number one biggest and number one richest thing in the world. They have 1.4 billion people. And so China is not, we're being told in this country that China's a third world country rising. That's not what's happening. China had a 400-year blip with the Industrial Revolution, but China's just reassuming its natural position. China doesn't see its rise as, like, you know, unusual, or they're not surprised by it.
We're visiting with James Bradley. He is the author of the recent book, The China Mirage, The Hidden History of American Disaster in Asia. James, one of the things that we read about also in other history books and just in the news, but especially in your book, the fact that they did have, I guess, their own dream, Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin, about Asia, and the fact that one of them was in love with, if you want to say love, Japan, and the other one with China.
Yeah, Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt went to Harvard when that was a tiny, tiny, extremely elite club. And the elite club was only the East Coast, white Christian, you know, no Jews, no women, just think, no women. It was just East Coast small type club. And then into that club come some Asians. In Theodore Roosevelt's life, it was a Japanese baron, a former samurai, and he formed a friendship with Theodore Roosevelt and tilted American policy towards Japan. Strangely enough, and incredibly enough, Franklin Roosevelt was also influenced by a close Harvard friend, but this was a Chinese financier. Franklin favored China. Theodore Roosevelt favored Japan. And this is a pattern in U.S. relations. Look at right now, the Japanese are the good Asians, the Chinese are the bad Asians. In World War II, the Japanese were the bad Asians, the Chinese were the good Asians. We only have, in American history, how we see China and Japan continues to flip.
And you mentioned in your book about how all of this, the mirage, affected general history in the U.S. and world history and some of the battles and wars that we've been in. And so you mentioned Vietnam a little while ago, but the book also mentions Korea.
It does. Mao sent an emissary to Washington to plead with President Truman and the wise man Secretary of State Dean Acheson to not threaten the Chinese border, and then Mao wouldn't have to enter what was just a little Korean civil war. Secretary of State Acheson said Mao's bluffing and threw the warning aside, and a little war became a big war. Again, it's just like today. If you read the headlines, we have people in Washington who are telling us about China, but they know very little about China. When I was a kid, the reason we had to be in Vietnam, the reason my brother and my neighborhood buddies that I played football with, the reason they had to go fight in Vietnam was because of a theory. They called it the domino theory. Well, the domino theory wasn't about Vietnam. It was about China, that China was going to topple Vietnam like a domino and then take over all the rest of Southeast Asia. Louis, we went with a Washington theory. At the end of his life, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, who ran the Vietnam War, said, gee, the domino theory was never debated at the top levels of government. 58,000 American dead.
We're visiting with James Bradley. He is the New York Times bestselling author of books, The Flags of Our Fathers, Flyboys, and the recent one is The China Mirage, The Hidden History of American Disaster in Asia. Now, you mentioned earlier, James, that perhaps we went to war, that a lot of people think that we went to war because of Pearl Harbor and that we went to Europe because of Hitler and trying to help England. But in your book, you paint us a different story.
Yes, I just say to the listeners that if you want to believe that the Japanese were just irrational and they were so militarily crazy that they just happened to bomb us at Pearl Harbor out of pique and there was nothing behind that, then you can continue to believe that. I believe that for much of my life, and I got a degree in East Asian history. If you look at the facts, you see that what Japan and China were arguing about was the future of China. And America wanted that Chiang Kai-shek new China, that Americanized, Christianized China. And Chiang Kai-shek was able to take American funds and start a China lobby organization in downtown Manhattan, two blocks from the New York Public Library, that propagandized public opinion and convinced 75% of American public opinion that we could cut off Japan's oil with no problem. Franklin Delano Roosevelt disagreed. He said, I'm keeping peace in the Pacific by selling Japan oil. Japan has only two gas pumps, California and Indonesia. If I cut off the California pump, FDR reasoned, Japan will go south to Indonesia with their military, and the U.S. will be involved in a war. I don't want war in the Pacific, Roosevelt told his advisors. Keep the oil going. So Roosevelt leaves town secretly, goes to Canada to meet with Churchill, and some wise men in his administration, four levels down, cut Japan's oil. That was the reason for Pearl Harbor. World War II in the Pacific was a preventable war. Roosevelt was planning to go to war in Europe. He didn't have plans for Asia because he thought he could keep the peace by keeping the oil open, and Roosevelt got sandbagged.
And actually, we didn't go to war in Europe until after Hitler declared war on us, correct?
Yes. You know, American school kids and some adults are walking around, you know, they're being told the United States went into World War II to defend democracy in Europe against Hitler. That didn't happen. Japan hit us. We declared war on Japan. The next day, Churchill's begging us to get involved in Europe. No, another day goes. It wasn't until on December 10th when Hitler finally declared war on us that we, in other words, World War II came from Asia. And it came from Asia because some Washington wise men, just like today, don't understand China and are feeding us theories about what is going to happen out there in Asia.
We're visiting with James Bradley. He is the author of the book, The China Mirage. And for those of you who are listening right now, make no mistake. This is not myself or James going against our government or putting down the fact that we should have done something like that or this. But he's given us the history of the China relations between the United States and China and Asia, other parts of Asia. I'm interested in something you said earlier, James, about the fact that we spend all our monies on Iran, and with a quarter of the world's population living in China, yet we're dumping all our money on Iran, or most of our money.
Yeah, the wars, they're very big, very busy, very profitable. But the U.S. Navy now is confronting China over some sand in the Pacific. President Xi of China said to John Kerry, the Pacific is big enough for China and the United States, but the U.S. Navy has kind of drawn the American border right at the border of China. And if you look at the headlines, it's getting kind of scary.
We're reading about the different things that people growing up, as you mentioned, you and I and our buddies, I was too young to go to Vietnam. You and I are about the same age, and the fact that when we read these things about what was going on and even literature, they tried to paint us a very good picture of, as you mentioned, the China Mirage. And Pearl Buck, another well-known author here in the United States, and I'm going to read one of the quotes from your book. She says, the Chinese make a good Christians, not because they get converted from anything to anything, but because of the extreme good sense as expressed in the Golden Rule, which is the basis of Christianity. The product of another old race is natural to the Chinese. Pearl Buck.
Yeah, Pearl Buck was the number one author of the 1930s, and it's important to see what she did. She wrote a book that was number one for 2 years in a row. That's amazing. And as everyone knows, it's called The Good Earth, one of the best-selling books ever in the United States. And it was about China and loving the Chinese. Now, at the same time, it was illegal for a Chinese to come to the United States. Americans didn't want to live next to a Chinese. We had the Chinese exclusion laws. Chinese were legislated out of this country, and we took guns and shoved them off the West Coast and into the sea. So that's the China mirage. Pearl Buck writes a book, we fall in love with those Chinese who want to be Americanized and Christianized. She gets the Nobel Prize. There's a movie about it. But at the same time, when those moviegoers walked out of the movie, they were walking on streets where U.S. laws protected them from having to run into a Chinese person.
That's incredible, and a lot of people aren't aware of that. And some people might wonder, well, is that kind of the effect that perhaps our policy is now, immigration policy, towards other people who are non-Americans?
Well, in particular, it was the Chinese. There was no concept of illegal immigration in the United States until 1882. Before then, there was no such thing as an illegal immigrant. Anybody could come. In 1882, the Senate, in their wisdom, said that the Chinese are unusual. See, you can get democracy into these other people's heads, but you can't get it into the Chinese noggins. The Chinese can't absorb democracy. Therefore, we have to exclude them. They're the only people we will exclude from the United States, from our mosaic, was the Chinese. So at the time, again, a mirage. At the time we're putting up the Statue of Liberty in New York, we are the chief of police of Seattle rounded up everybody in Chinatown at gunpoint and put them on a ship and shoved it out to the ocean.
What about the opinion of Chinese people, Chinese Americans now, or people in China? What is their vision or version of the China mirage and what the United States thinks about them?
What the United States thinks about them? You know, I have some idea, but no idea. It's hard to talk about 1.4 billion people, and the Chinese live all over the world. But in terms of, see, the problem hasn't been how China viewed us. It's been how we viewed China. We excluded China. After World War II, we said we'll have no relations with China. That got us into Korea and Vietnam. So this idea that America has a leash on China and can influence China's behavior, that's a mirage.
So does China have a mirage about us?
Probably, but they're not. You know, you're down in Texas. You don't have Chinese aircraft carriers in the Gulf. You didn't send millions of Americans to go fight. I mean, they didn't send millions of Chinese to go fight in California like we did in Vietnam because we didn't understand China. So the experience, it matters what Americans think because we've got aircraft carriers and troops over there. And we're reacting in a way that we shows we still don't understand, you know, what China is doing. I'll put it this way. My dad taught me how to drive on Highway 45 in northern Wisconsin. If I was out there with my dad and he saw the biggest truck on the road, that's the Chinese truck, one-fourth of humanity. He would say, just watch, you know, you got to pay attention to that truck or you're going to get in a collision. If I'm going to look at my cell phone and imagine how I want that truck to go, there's going to be a collision. Those are called wars. 200,000 Americans have died in three preventable wars because of the China mirage. This book is not a call for us to like China. It's a call for us to understand China so that we can stop shooting our collective feet off in Asia.
James, thank you very much for being with us here today. We've been visiting with James Bradley. James is the New York Times bestselling author of books, Flags of Our Fathers, Flyboys, The China Mirage. And you can go to Facebook and meet the author, and you can find various things there about the China Mirage. There's also a page on Amazon, and you can also Google The China Mirage and find out also about the other book I forgot to mention was The Imperial Cruise. James, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Louis, thanks. And this your interview and all the others will be up at jamesbradley.com.
Thank you. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Belinda Fernandez. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.